Hey, true crime fans. Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. After all, ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/adfreetruecrime. That's amazon.com/adfreetruecrime to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes in detail.
Bombas makes the most comfortable socks, underwear, and T-shirts.
Warning, Bombas are so absurdly comfortable you may throw out all your other clothes.
Sorry, do we legally have to say that?
No, this is just how I talk, and I really love my Bombas.
They do feel that good, and they do good, too. One item purchased equals one item donated.
To feel good and do good, go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST at checkout.
Hey, it's Sharon, and here's where it gets interesting. Raise your hand if you want salon-perfect nails for just $2 a manicure. Yeah, me too. With the Alvin June Manny system, you can say goodbye to expensive services that take hours and hours and love your nails more than ever. I would know. I've been doing it for years. Get 20% off your first Manny system with code PERFECTMANNY20 at alvinjune.com/PERFECTMANNY20. That's PERFECTMANNY20 at alvinjune.com/PERFECTMANNY20.
Before we get going with this episode, check out what's going on over at Patreon. Here's a preview of our Little Alarms series, only available on Patreon.
So do you think that you will put up a sign for your guests that says, please lower lid before flushing?
No, I can't. I'm not going to like micromanage someone's bathroom time. But like, I think like, for us, obviously we are, I am. Actually, I didn't even know I've had like a real conversation with Mike about this. So now I'm alarmed about
that. Uh-oh. How is that going to go?
He's going to be like, one more thing Clayton wants me to do. But, I do have a lot of little things. I'm like, can you just do it this way around the house? Because it makes me feel better.
We know about those.
Fold the blanket that way.
Rebecca and I call this roommate problem.
Yeah,
call
it's this a roommate. Roommate to sit down and have a roommate conversation.
Yeah.
Go to patreon.com/thealarmist and subscribe today. Now, on to our episode. Each week, we decide who's to blame for a historical tragedy. And each week, you tell us if we got it right. My name is Rebecca Delgado-Smith, and this is The Aftermath. The Aftermath. Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning into this episode of The Aftermath. Today we're speaking with guest expert Jordana Gessler. Jordana, the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors, is the chief impact officer at Holocaust Museum LA. Let's hear what she has to say about Sophie's Choice. Hi, Jordana. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Rebecca. Thank you so much for having me.
So can you start off by telling us a little bit about your personal connection to the Holocaust and how you came to your position at the Holocaust Museum in LA?
Of course. So my grandparents were Holocaust survivors, and that always instilled in me an interest in family history, understanding why my grandparents had accents, why their family trees were different from my classmates' family trees, and just really being interested in the cultural aspect of my family and looking into history in general. I started researching Holocaust history and followed my passion into an academic career and really felt that there's a power in museum spaces and public education and being able to connect people with history who might not be able to learn that much about it. And so at a certain point, I thought, you know, instead of going down academic paths, why don't I go into public education and museum work, which is about preservation and preserving stories and artifacts and connecting with the larger public.
Now, we watched the movie Sophie's Choice, and
it is about a Polish concentration camp survivor who comes to America and deals with this incredible trauma that she experienced and that so many experienced. Can you start by giving us some historical context? It feels like an impossible ask, but how did the Nazis come into power, and how did their ideas take hold?
Of course. So yes, the film takes place in Auschwitz, which is in modern day Poland, and Auschwitz as a camp is established shortly after the outbreak of World War II, after Operation Tannenberg, which is when the Nazis established the camp as a place to exploit Polish prisoners. It slowly quickly is transformed during the Holocaust to become a place of extreme industrial mass murder. Over about 1.1 million people are murdered in Auschwitz, and 90% of them are Jews from across Europe and even North Africa. And, you know, you're asking a question about, like, how did this happen? But it really begins in about almost a decade before that, when there's a rise in power in Germany, where basically political parties are taking advantage of the economic strife in the country, the social strife in the country, the fledgling democracy in Weimar Germany, and Hitler and the Nazis gain power at first through a democratic process, but really then cement a dictatorship in which they can take their ideology and make that law and really transform the ideas of people to hate one another and to other one another and to scapegoat a small minority group. And the concentration camp system is actually established very quickly after Hitler is appointed chancellor in 1933. And that system of creating concentration camps where people are sent who oppose the Nazis, who have different beliefs or who the Nazis deem as other, is established then through 40,000 ghettos and camps throughout Europe before the end of 1945. Auschwitz, of course, being the most infamous and ultimately the largest of these camps, and of course then has the unique aspect of being used for industrial mass murder.
And the story is told partially from the perspective of this young American writer, Singo. Mm-hmm. What was a typical American perspective during Germany's rise to power in Europe, and how did this shift during and after the war?
Yeah, unfortunately, in the 1930s, there was a decent amount of anti-Semitism here in the United States. There are public opinion polls showing that most Americans did not want to accept additional Jewish refugees from Europe. And this was really tied with xenophobia and racism and anti-Semitism that existed in the 20s and 30s. There was a lot of news and reporting on what was going on in Europe. Researchers have found that every single state in the country had at least one newspaper that was reporting on actual timely information of what was transpiring during the Holocaust. In fact, by the end of 1942, it's known that half of the Jews in Europe have already been murdered. And I think that the perception in the United States starts to shift a little bit when Pearl Harbor takes place and the U.S. is actively engaged in the war. And then following the end of the war in 1945, when the American soldiers are confronted with the liberation of the concentration camps, although I will mention Auschwitz is liberated by the Soviets, but other concentration camps that are liberated by the Americans, and the true violence of the Nazi crimes comes to light through photographic evidence taken by many soldiers. And this is the beginning of more open conversations around the Holocaust. I will say, however, that, and this is where film plays such an important role, conversations around the Holocaust in the United States are not, or globally, are really not taking place shortly after. I mean, our understanding of PTSD doesn't really develop until after Vietnam. For many immigrants who are survivors coming to the United States, there's a pressure to assimilate, there's a desire to assimilate and create a new life. And so social public conversation and discourse around the Holocaust really doesn't open up until a different Meryl Streep series, which is the miniseries Holocaust, is in the 1970s. And so this is an interesting viewpoint for Sophie's Choice, because Sophie's Choice is created in this very beginning opening in the United States, where there are more public discourse around the Holocaust specifically. However, of course, you know, various artworks in a broad spectrum of disciplines have directly and indirectly employed the Holocaust as the thematic backdrop for the stories that they're trying to tell. I mean, this starts shortly after the war and continues till today, but you really do see this shift in the 70s and early 80s. And it is in part because of Sophie's Choice, which has become, I think, a very a defining moment in our public consumption of Holocaust film.
Now, while working as a secretary, Sophie, the main character, tries to save her son by convincing the commander to send him to the Lebensborn program. What was this a real program? What was its purpose?
Yes. So the Lebensborn program is a real program, and it really fits in. I mentioned before about how the Nazis took their ideology and made it into law and practice. And this fills in with their racial beliefs and their pseudoscience. So the Nazi pseudoscientists basically believed that the entire world was made up of different races. The Aryan race, which is what they considered themselves, being at the very top of this hierarchy, Jews being at the very bottom, and sort of different people falling in between. Sophie happens to be a Polish Catholic, and the Nazis place Eastern Europeans lower down on this racial hierarchy. However, they were also very engaged and interested in increasing Germany's population. And the Nazi government employed this pressure to increase Germany's population in a plethora of different ways, some of which are all of them are quite shocking. One included giving medals to women who produced enough children to be worn similarly to military medals, and different medals meant that they had produced a certain number of children for the Reich, because the Nazis believed that this was not just for the individual or for the family, but for the entire community, the Volksgemeinschaft, the people's community. And so the Lebensborn program is this program where, in part, pregnant German women who might not be married are encouraged to give up their children to people who don't have kids. But then really horrifically, children in Eastern Europe and in Poland who are deemed quote unquote racially valuable or look quote unquote Aryan are actually taken from parents and given to couples in Germany. And so there is this this really smaller part of this history where children are kidnapped and are given to couples and ripped apart from their families, and people lose their kids because of this. So yes, this is a real part of the history that took place. And it's quite horrific to think about, especially because it highlights how pseudoscientific this belief was. Because if the Nazis truly believed in the biology of race, then of course someone quote unquote looking to be part of the race wouldn't quite fit. And so you do see how their beliefs were so undermined by fact. But yes, they intended to provide German couples with children who looked Aryan.
Ryan Reynolds here for, I guess, my 100th Mint commercial. No, don't. I mean, honestly, when I started this, I thought I only have to do like 4 of these. I mean, it's unlimited premium wireless for $15 a month. How are there still people paying 2 or 3 times that much? I'm sorry, I shouldn't be victim blaming here. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch. Whenever you're ready.
$45 upfront payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes. See details.
Hey, true crime fans. Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. After all, ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/adfreetruecrime. That's amazon.com/adfreetruecrime to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
And Sophie's big choice centers around her being forced to buy a guard in the concentration camp to choose one of her children to be sent to a camp and then the other one to die. Were there accounts of this sort of thing happening in concentration camps?
So first I would say that, you know, the Nazis and their collaborators, their cruel, torturous treatment of Jews, of camp prisoners, of anyone they deemed as other and less than, stemmed from a total disregard of human life and human beings. The entire Holocaust is a process of dehumanization. And this scene, I think, is representative of the choiceless choices that every single person who survived the Holocaust had to make, whether or not it's, you know, the very specific picking which child is being sent to the gas chambers. I think it's just more representative of the impossible moments so many people faced in survival. And this can stem from survivor accounts of deciding if they should hide or follow orders or separate from their children or send their children to a different place to hide, to being in concentration camps and if they should steal a piece of food. And I think that really understanding this trauma that Sophie went through is understanding that during the Holocaust, people had to make extraordinary choices in order to survive. And they were choiceless choices. They had no choice except to make them. And in fact, you can see, you know, in survivor testimony, most famously Elie Wiesel in Night, at the very end of Night, the Soviets are coming to liberate Auschwitz, and his father wants to stay in Auschwitz because there are these death marches that the Nazis are trying to evacuate the prisoners. And Ellie's father says, like, let's stay. And Ellie says, no, we should really just go. Let's not stay. I don't trust it. And his father ends up dying on that death march. And I think you can read between the lines and see that this choice that's made, this choiceless choice, Ellie lives with that guilt for the rest of his life. You know, that I can only guess, hope that maybe if they had stayed or thought if they had stayed, his father would have survived. So whether or not, you know, Nazis personally were very cruel, I mean, they were very cruel, and force people to make a choice between their children, that very well must have happened. But I think it's more representative of the broader spectrum of choices people had to make. And you see this time and time again in different survivor testimony. I mean, kind of related, and I think Sophie's choice reminds me a lot of this, is Art Spiegelman, who wrote Maus, his parents, and how his parents made a decision to separate from their child, thinking their child would be safer in a different location, and their child ends up being killed in the Holocaust. And this is a heaviness that his parents live with, and his mother ultimately takes her own life. In part, we can guess, because of some of the guilt she carries. Mm-hmm. And so these stories are real, and even if though Sophie's choice is not a actual true story, they speak to this inability to understand the environment that took place. I mean, I think that no true work can ever truly depict the atrocities of the Holocaust, but films like Sophie's Choice are created to allow us, the viewers, us human beings, to try to comprehend the different parts of this gruesome catastrophe.
Mm. And while at the camp, she's selected to be a secretary, presumably because she speaks German and other languages. Was this typical? What prisoners were given this? This kind of job, were some prisoners treated better than others? What was this situation that she found herself in?
Yes. So there are many different prisoners in Auschwitz. I mentioned Jews and of course, Polish Catholic, like Sophie. There were also criminals and political dissidents sent to the concentration camps like Auschwitz. And so there is actually a prisoner hierarchy that's created where criminals like murderers and rapists could be treated much better than human beings who are just deemed by the Nazis to be racially inferior. Because Sophie is not Jewish, She is not part of the group that's specifically targeted for complete annihilation and mass murder. And so she is offered, or could have been offered, different, better positions within the camp. And then, of course, being able to speak German would have been helpful for survival in a concentration camp, 100%. There are many instances of survivors being able to survive or attributing their survival in part to languages that they spoke. And then, of course, also being identified as not Jewish. So different tasks within the concentration camp. I mean, the Nazis used slave labor to profit enormously off of the Holocaust. I mean, there are several major corporations that still exist today that profited during the Holocaust off of slave labor, specifically in Auschwitz. For Jews who were selected for slave labor, the Nazis actually had a phrase that meant destruction through work, which was that they were going to exploit the work with the intention of eventually killing those populations, whereas some more privileged positions would have just been forced to work as slave labor, where the Nazis had no regard for human life. And that's where we see Sophie's position, where she is treated potentially a little bit more privileged than others, is able to work in an office, which would sort of keep her away from like the harsh, harsh winters and the very humid summers. And also because of her language skills, yes, that would have been able to help in those situations.
In the movie, the commandant of Auschwitz, Rudolf Haas, is depicted in several scenes. Sophie is brought into his home briefly. Can you tell us more about him? Who is he, and what was his connection?
Yes, so it is actually very interesting to look at that, because there's been more recently a lot of film work specifically about the commandant of Auschwitz, and also understanding the role that German supervisors played in the concentration camp system. And the depictions are that many of them lived seemingly pleasant lives. They would have their families nearby. They would have offices. They would be able to take valuables that were taken from the possessions of the victims. You know, Rudolf Hoff did have his family nearby, did live in a beautiful estate on some level, would have enjoyed the same daily comforts that that feel so unimaginable for the place and the specific site of what is the atrocities that are taking place. There is actually a photographic album of photographs that have recently been digitized and are saved in the collection of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum that show Auschwitz SS and Nazi officers enjoying picnics not too far away from Auschwitz, eating blueberries, playing music, laughing, being joyous. And that juxtaposition between sort of their lives and the dehumanization that's taking place mere feet from them, I think is really shocking and a reminder for the capacity of human beings to make choices and to be horrific to one another, but then also remind us that there are opportunities for us to be supportive and kind to one another and coming down to those choices.
A big twist in the film is when we learn that Sophie's father was a professor who shared anti-Semitic hatred similar to the Nazis, but was killed by them when they did a sweep of the university. What threat did academics and intellectuals pose to the Nazis?
It's an excellent question. And I think also like this important piece of this subtleness or these micro histories within the Holocaust that oftentimes aren't discussed. So when Nazi Germany invades Poland initially in September of 1939, part of Operation Tannenberg, part of their intention is to remove intellectuals and to really disable society in a way to better control it. And so anyone who was considered to be influential or academic, whether it be principals or spiritual leaders, who could be seen as a threat to the Nazis because they are looking to completely control and occupy Eastern Europe and these areas and regions. And of course, they view it as easier to do so if they remove people who can be viewed as leaders. Mm. And also, I should mention that anti-Semitic beliefs range, and I mean, hatred towards Jews has existed, unfortunately, for thousands of years, and anti-Jewish tropes appear in different ways. And there are cases of Polish Catholics having anti-Semitic feelings because of the false belief that Jews killed Jesus. And this is a religious anti-Semitism that has existed for hundreds of years. And, you know, after the Holocaust, the Catholic Church came out and sort of dispelled a lot of this misinformation. But during the Holocaust, there were people who felt this way and were not Nazis and, you know, disagreed with the Nazis and were targeted by the Nazis. I mean, there's an incredible book. It's a memoir called Dry Tears by Nahama Tech. And she and her sister and her parents are hidden by a Polish Catholic family. They're Polish Jewish. And the Polish Catholic family is anti-Semitic in this way, that they view Nahama's family as other, that, you know, are held responsible for killing Jesus, are viewed as dirty and other, and have this animosity towards them. And basically throughout the memoir, you actually see the humanization of the two families. And by the end of it, there is this relationship. And I think that also speaks to different things that we can do in our lives to, you know, if we view a group as other, if we view a person as other, oftentimes it comes from not understanding it or not knowing somebody, and really spending time to learn about that culture, to learn about the religion, to learn about that ethnicity, to sort of get to know our peers in this space, in the communities, in the cities. I think this is a lesson within itself, that many, many stereotypes come from a place of misinformation, and we can actually work against them and form bonds with one another. So yes, it's very plausible that Sophie's father could have been anti-Semitic, but also have been anti-Nazi and would have been targeted because of his position in the university. So, but this is a sort of a microcosm of the complexities of this time. Mm.
To get people excited about Boost Mobile's new nationwide 5G network, we're offering unlimited talk, text, and data for $25 a month.
Forever.
Even if you have a baby.
Even if your baby has a baby.
Even if you grow old and wrinkly and you start repeating yourself.
Even if you start repeating yourself.
Even if you're on your deathbed and you need to make one last call.
Or text.
Right, or text. The long-lost son you abandoned at birth.
You'll still get unlimited talk, text, and data for just $25 a month with Boost Mobile.
Forever!
After 30 gigabytes, customers may experience slower speeds. Customers will pay $25 a month as long as they remain active on the Boost Unlimited plan.
Forever.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes in detail.
Bombas makes the most comfortable socks, underwear, and T-shirts.
Warning, Bombas are so absurdly comfortable you may throw out all your other clothes.
Sorry, do we legally have to say that?
No, this is just how I talk, and I really love my Bombas.
They do feel that good, and they do good, too. One item purchased equals one item donated.
To feel good and do good, go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST at checkout.
Hey, it's Sharon, and here's where it gets interesting. Raise your hand if you want salon-perfect nails for just $2 a manicure. Yeah, me too. With the Alvin June Manny system, you can say goodbye to expensive services that take hours and hours and love your nails more than ever. I would know. I've been doing it for years. Get 20% off your first Manny system with code PERFECTMANNY20 at olivandjune.com/PERFECTMANNY20. That's PERFECTMANNY20 at olivandjune.com/PERFECTMANNY20.
Were there others like Sophie's father who welcomed Nazis into their country or cities? Why? How is this possible?
Yeah, unfortunately, yes, this does take place. And also in Eastern Europe. I mean, there's a larger power shift between the Soviet Union and concepts around communism, and the Soviet Union occupying and taking also different countries. And then of course, Nazi Germany, which it represents something different. And some people who had been under Soviet oppression for quite some time or were fearful of communism in Eastern Europe could have welcomed the Nazis in this way, could have seen it as opportunities for themselves. Of course, less likely to be people who were targeted by the Nazis for mass murder and genocide, but people could have seen this as an economic opportunity, a political opportunity, an opportunity to escape potentially the Soviet Union. Unfortunately, the Nazi government actually plays into this in Eastern Europe, plays into the political tensions, mostly in places like Lithuania and Ukraine, where they do exploit the desire to be free of the Soviet Union to their advantage. And so, yes, there is also this play between world powers and political structures.
For many, the end of the war was only the beginning. What kind of trauma did survivors of the Holocaust face after they were liberated from concentration camps? Where did they go? I know you touched on this a little bit earlier.
Yeah, so after the Holocaust, many and most Holocaust survivors did not feel safe in returning to their homes, did not want to return to their homes. There are survivors who do remain in Europe for various reasons, but for the majority, either because of continued anti-Semitism and violence or because of the understanding that their entire families and communities have been murdered, decide that they no longer want to stay in Europe. And in 1948, the United States does allow these displaced survivors to come to the United States. And so there is an influx of immigration of survivors to the US. And it is a very difficult, it's very difficult to think about how people survive something so traumatic. I always wonder, how did somebody survive Auschwitz and like stop at a stop sign while driving a car and do these small things every day to be part of society? And it's fascinating to really look at the human resiliency. And there's been many, many studies around this where researchers look at different coping strategies, everything from seeking social support, endurance, planful problem solving. Some, you know, attribute it to supernatural protection or relationship forming and forming bonds, and then also luck. I mean, we do see this in Sophie's Choice, where there is this mention of luck, where Sophie sort of attributes part of her survival during the Holocaust to luck. And this is, I think, tinged with her survivor's guilt, but really looking at how survival was so arbitrary during the Holocaust. And time again, researchers and psychologists and psychiatrists have found that many, many survivors point to luck as being one of the reasons why they survived. But also attributing their survival to a combination of personal characteristics and external factors. But the extreme trauma that many survivors felt and continue to feel is uncovered, I think, in Sophie's Choice, and really starting to understand what an event like this would do to a person and how potentially then the question, of course, is what can we do to care for people who've experienced these things? But I do think when you look at Sophie in particular, the situation that she faced as a mother, but then also coming to the United States and not having strong connections, not having something that could help her endure, ultimately then leads to more fracturing within her psyche and her emotional state. I mean, in studies with Holocaust survivors, years after the Holocaust, because of course Sophie's Choice takes place shortly after the Holocaust, but in interviews that are done decades later, there is a trend that survivors were pushed to survive, to be resilient because of their family ties, and that would continue after the war, and that they attributed their persistence and their ability to continue afterwards to important factors related to family or societal bonds. And we do see that Sophie does not have that. Mm. And that could also attribute to how her trauma continues to fester. I mean, I do think that there is this maybe belief or misinformation that most, or a lot of stereotypes, that survivors were guilt-ridden, depressed, and withdrawn. And those are factors within PTSD and experiences of trauma. But there are also moments of resilience that we see every single day by Holocaust survivors. And I think more complexity in how people can have space for all of these emotions and feelings, but also her post-war experience negatively impacts and allows her trauma to really fester.
So you mentioned that No work can depict the environment of the Holocaust. But what is the obligation or the undertaking of other movies that attempt to make this depiction of museums who try to educate? As a Holocaust movie, what does Sophie's Choice get right? What does it get wrong? How can films like this help us better comprehend this unthinkable tragedy?
I think at its core, what Sophie's Choice gets right is the complexity of human emotion and the need to be more empathetic and understanding to others, especially others who experience trauma. I think that Holocaust movies can always get something wrong and I can sit there and nitpick all of the things, but instead just focusing, I think, on like the larger themes of what Holocaust films or books or museums are trying to get across. And at its core, I believe it's that understanding human nature and understanding human capacity. And yes, there are many different Holocaust films, and some of them are dark humor, some of them are humorous, like Life is Beautiful, I think is a great example of another fictional story where you can see the ways in which a father-son relationship can attribute to not just physical, but emotional survival. I think that in Sophie's Choice, you can really see how trauma is something that needs to be addressed. And to me, the most crucial part of it is that you see the post effects of the war. You know, I always say the Holocaust doesn't end in 1945. Of course, the event ends in 1945, but for the people who survived the Holocaust, it does not end. It never ends. And I think our understanding of that is what is important from Sophie's Choice, especially because of when the movie comes out. I mentioned earlier, it's the beginning of the understanding of PTSD research and the fact that there is this post experience of people. And so I think the bigger message is compassion and empathy towards others, thinking about the experience of others before we make judgments and really spending time and sitting with that. And for me, that's at the core of what Sophie's Choice is.
So we all ask all of our guest experts this final question. At the end of the day, if you had to pick a person or thing, it could be a concept that you think is to blame for the events that occur in the movie Sophie's Choice, who or what would that be?
I would say it's dehumanization. Dehumanization is what takes place time and time again in Sophie's Choice, whether it's something like Sophie's father being anti-Semitic and viewing Jews as other, whether it's Nazi Germany's Lebensborn program viewing certain people of deserving children versus others, whether it's the Nazi guard who forces Sophie to make a choiceless choice in selecting which one of her children could potentially survive. Time and time again, dehumanization is what is to blame for much of what is transpiring around us. And I think that confronting that and restoring humanity to living beings around us is the cure to it.
Jordana, we so appreciate you speaking with us today. Thank you so much.
It was such an honor. Thank you very much for having me and for having this conversation about a film that's already, 50 years old or much, much older than that.
I can't believe it.
I know the 80s feel like they were 20 years ago, but the themes in it are still so relevant to today. So thank you.
We're going to head over to Patreon and continue the conversation. If you'd like to hear our post-interview discussion and final verdict, head over to Patreon and subscribe. Your support is greatly appreciated. Check out our show notes for a link or head over to patreon.com/thealarmist. And stay tuned because next week we'll be discussing the Banana Massacre. The Alarmist.
Powered by Acast.
Thank you.
To make switching to the new Boost Mobile risk-free, we're offering a 30-day money-back guarantee.
So why wouldn't you switch from Verizon or T-Mobile?
Because you have nothing to lose. Boost Mobile is offering a 30-day money-back guarantee.
No, I asked why wouldn't you switch from Verizon or T-Mobile?
Oh.
Wouldn't.
Because you love wasting money as a way to punish yourself because your mother never showed you enough love as a child?
Whoa. Easy there.
Yeah.
Applies to online activations. Requires port-in and auto-pay. Customers activating in stores may be charged non-refundable activation fees.
This is a mini meditation guided by Bombas. Repeat after me. I'm comfy.
Comfy.
I'm cozy.
Cozy.
I have zero blisters on my toes.
Blisters.
And that's because I wear Bombas. The softest socks, underwear, and t-shirts that give back. One purchased equals one donated. Now go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST at checkout.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.